Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. This morning from Canto 3, Chapter 24, verses 14 and 15. You get a context so we understand the situation here. This is the chapter is the renunciation of Kardama Muni. So the overall theme is that Kardama Muni is finished with his family duties, and he's going to be departing from his family life and returning back to the forest to continue his practices. It's Satya Yuga, so the means for achieving perfection in Satya Yuga is meditation. Of course, the purpose of meditation is to enter into a life of unalloyed devotion. It's not just a neutrality thing, it's a life of devotion. The scene is Lord Brahma has come, and this, again, step back a bit from earlier chapters. In this Canto 3, details of the process of creation are laid out. A little different than Big Bang cosmology and chemical evolution. It's a very, very different picture. Canto 2 touches on the topic creation. Canto 3 expands on the topic. Included in what's coming up is the unfolding of the elements, the whole of Sankhya philosophy. But Sankhya philosophy is just describing what precedes Kapila Dev's teachings of Sankhya philosophy from third canto, that is, the details of the unfolding of the creation. And then Sankhya philosophy's further details on those details. The principle is there's one source. The Vedanta is inquiring what's that source, what's the absolute truth. The absolute truth is the source from which everything else comes. Other things may be causes of some results, and those results may be causes of some other results, but what's the original cause that has no other cause? Vedanta is searching for that. The Vedas are searching for that. And Bhagavatam is revealing. That's Krishna. So, without going into all of the unfolding parts, Lord Brahma, after appearing on the lotus of Garbhadakshay Vishnu, Lord Brahma undergoes penance, which means the control of his senses and fixing his mind on the personality of Godhead through mantra. And he comes to realize his identity. He becomes empowered by the personality of Godhead, etc., etc., etc. He creates the universe. So after the universe is created, what's left? Well, he has to fill it up, or it's a service for him. And so one of the ways that he does that is from his own body he expands different entities, some of whom, among whom are the first Manu, Swayambhuva Manu, and his wife Shatrurupa, and interestingly, they're manifest in their full adult, mature form. It's a little special. They have children. Devahuti is the first of the three daughters. And this whole section is Devahuti's marriage to Kardama Muni. So Kardama Muni is, along with other sages, other rishis, he's one, a direct son of Lord Brahma. And Lord Brahma gives him a specific instruction. And the specific instruction is, please assist me in the service of filling up the universe that I've created on behalf of Lord Vishnu with good praja. And his answer is yes. Different than the answer of the four Kumaras. He said no. I'm not polite, but no. So he said yes. He went to the forest to qualify himself, and in the course of doing so, his pure devotion in service to his father, Lord Brahma, but his pure devotion for whom he was doing even the service for his father, which was the satisfaction of Lord Vishnu. Lord Vishnu appeared in the middle of the forest, in the beginning of Satya Yuga, and identified his desire that I know that your desire is that I would become your son, and I will become your son. You please me very much by your devotion. You become married to Devahuti. They were married. And so he knew before they were married that he, Kardama, and Devahuti would have Lord Vishnu as their son. And so it was. Long, long time they spent undergoing purification by the Satya Yuga process. After thousands, tens of thousands of years of that, Kardama arranged a celestial vimana. He didn't even say a mantra, he just desired it, and voila, it was this celestial city in which he and Devahuti traveled throughout the universe, visiting various places, not as tourists, but as visiting great personalities and sacred places throughout the universe. And then nine daughters were born all at once. Another very interesting episode from the earlier section. And then the end of chapter 23, Devahuti is lamenting that I have simply become attached on the material platform to such a great personality as my life's companion, a perfected soul, and I've become attached in a material way, and I've neglected the most important part of the purpose of our relationship, and that is your giving me liberation, or the path to liberation. I've neglected to ask, and I'm feeling great sorrow for that. This chapter 24 begins. Kardama Muni says, no need for lamentation. You're a great personality. And very soon, within your womb, Lord Vishnu will appear. So now, he already knows that it's going to happen. Now he's telling Devahuti it's going to happen. And it happens that Devahuti becomes pregnant, and within her womb is Lord Vishnu. He isn't given a name yet. It's going to be Kapila. But he knows that. And so does Lord Brahma, the father of Kardama Muni. So Lord Brahma pays a visit. It's one of those scenes within the Bhagavatam where whole assembly, there's a very nice BBT painting. Brahma doesn't, sometimes he comes alone, but in this case he came with various exalted sages and demigods. So the BBT painting shows the four Kumaras and Narada Muni and a whole host of great sages, and they're accompanying Brahma. So there's this scene at the hermitage of Kardama, and there's Kardama, there's Devahuti, there's the nine daughters, and then this dialogue begins between Lord Brahma. So he's the head of our sampradaya, he's one of the 12 Mahajans, he's the original receiver of all Vedic knowledge, and he's a unique personality, uniquely qualified, and he knows things that people don't know because of his qualification. So he comes, and the first thing he does in his words to Kardama is Kardama is his son, but he honors his son as being perfected being, a greatly fortunate perfected being, because you are now the soon to become father of Lord Vishnu. So you're as worshipable as Lord Vishnu, although you're my son. Then he explains how that happened. He got the favor of Lord Vishnu because of his taking the instruction of Lord Brahma to assist him in his service to Lord Vishnu to heart. And the word that's used a few verses before what we're going to be reading is nirvyalika. Nice word. Translated as non-deceptive penance. We spent a fair amount of time going over that, how that term is used in the Bhagavatam. There isn't some other motive, like the message of Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 2, Ahaituki. Hetu means cause, so devotional service that's rendered without motivation. That's pretty special, because everyone has desire. Yesterday evening we're speaking about desire, and desire impelled by ignorance is ignorant desire, and ignorant desire is desire separate from the interest of Lord Vishnu. This word nirvyalika, it's like Shuddha Bhakti. There isn't any other desire. So that takes a while to get there. But that was the qualification of Kardama. And he, one more time, he attained that position because of his devotion to Lord Vishnu and his acceptance of the instruction given by Lord Brahma, to simply do that with no other purpose than fulfill the desire of Lord Vishnu. That's no small thing. It's not a dovetail. The dovetail meaning, I have a desire, Krishna has a desire, so I'll do because Krishna has the desire and I like it. So there's a fair amount of me at the center, and the nirvyalika position is there's only one thing at the center, and the happiness, the intention, even the intention of the servitor is the satisfaction of the personality of Godhead through the medium of the satisfaction of the representative of the personality of Godhead. So there's lots of commentary, Prabhupada's purports on that topic. See, he's being honored by Lord Brahma and the Bhagavatam and Lord Vishnu as having that very special qualification. So now text 14, after honoring Kardamuni this way, the verse reads, Lord Brahma then praised Kardamuni's nine daughters, saying, All you thin-waisted daughters are certainly very chaste. I am sure they will increase the creation by their own descendants in various ways. Purport. In the beginning of creation, Brahma was concerned more or less with increasing the population, and when he saw that Kardava Muni had already begun 9 nice daughters, he was hopeful that through the daughters many children would come who would take charge of the creative principle of the material world. He was therefore happy to see them. The word Sumadhyama means, quote, a good daughter of a beautiful woman, unquote. If she has a thin waist, a woman is considered very beautiful. All the daughters of Kardamuni were of the same beautiful feature. So then he's giving instruction to Kardama in relation to his daughters. Text 15. Therefore today, please give away your daughters to the foremost of the sages with due regard for the girls' temperaments and likings, and thereby spread your fame all over the universe. I forgot something that's really important. When Kardama is speaking to Devahuti, she's beginning of the chapter, she's lamenting. He says, soon within your womb will appear as Lord Vishnu as your son, and he will deliver this path to liberation. So don't worry. You can stop your lamentation. You're highly qualified, and because of that, the personnel, not just me, but the personality of Godhead, will take care of that concern of yours. Okay, so now back to the 9 daughters. There's the creation, and there's the purpose of creation. Going back to the earlier parts of the third canto, the purpose of the creation is primarily to provide the living entities who are entangled in forgetfulness to have once again an opportunity to become relieved of that forgetfulness and become restored to their proper position, and the creation provides that opportunity. Now one can always say no, and then it gets another situation arises, the complications of karma and reward and punishment, or the complexities of material existence. That's not the intention. It's the consequence that people say no, but the intention is to provide this facility for restoring pure consciousness, removing forgetfulness. So after the structure is there, it needs to be populated with good population that can then can be example setters and guides, both for the population, the living entities that will take their birth, including in different species. So the human species has great impact on all other species. How humans conduct their activities, it's kind of obvious, but trees, without all the naming the species, human existence has significant impact. And then the modes of nature and so forth. So this is Satya Yuga, and the daughters are to assist in this. Naturally, Brahma sees that way because that's the service that's given to him. And these very qualified daughters can assist in that purpose of creation. So there's several things, several themes being woven into one text or one this chapter. The purpose of creation is being continued. the personality of Godhead, Kapila, is going to appear. He's going to give the means for achieving perfection by his teachings, not only to Devahuti, but since it's the very beginning of Satyayuga, he's going to give teachings that are for all the people of Satyayuga. And of course, even today in Kali Yuga, because the principles apply. The form is different, but the principles apply. Okay, so now the purport. The nine principal rishis or sages are Marichi, Atri, Angira, Palasya, Pulaha, Pratu, Brinku, Vashishta, and Artava. The tenth is Kardama. They're actually brothers. They're all direct sons of Lord Brahma. All these rishis are most important, and Brahma desired that the nine daughters already born of Kardama be handed over to them. Here two words are used very significantly. Yatha Shilam and Yatha Ruchi. The daughters should be handed over to the respective rishis, not blindly, but according to the combination of character, shilam, and taste, ruchi. That is the art of combining a man and woman. Man and woman should not be united simply on the consideration of sex life. There are many other considerations, especially character and taste. If the taste and character differ between the man and woman, their combination will be unhappy. Even about 40 years ago, in Indian marriages, the taste and character of the boy and girl were first of all matched, and then they were allowed to marry. This was done under the direction of the respective parents. The parents used to astrologically determine the character and tastes of the boy and girl, and when they corresponded, the match was selected. Quote, this girl and this boy are just suitable, and they should be married. Other considerations were less important. The same system was also advised in the beginning of the creation by Brahma. Quote, your daughter should be handed over to the rishis according to taste and character. Second paragraph. According to astrological calculation, a person is classified according to whether he belongs to the godly or demoniac quality. In that way, the spouse is selected. A girl of godly quality should be handed over to a boy of godly quality. A girl of demoniac quality should be handed over to a boy of demoniac quality. Then they will be happy. But if the girl is demoniac and the boy is godly, then the combination is incompatible. Semicolon. They cannot be happy in such a marriage. At the present moment, because boys and girls are not married according to quality and character, most marriages are unhappy. And there is divorce. In the final paragraph, it is foretold in the 12th canto of Bhagavatam that in this age of Kali, married life will be accepted on the consideration of sex only. Semicolon. When the boy and the girl are pleased in sex, they get married. And when there is deficiency in sex, they separate. That is not actual marriage, but a combination of men and women, men and women, like cats and dogs. Therefore, the children produced in the modern age are not exactly human beings. Human beings must be twice born. A child is first born of a good father and mother, and then he is born again of the spiritual master in the Vedas. The first mother and father bring about his birth into the world, semicolon, then the spiritual master in the Vedas become the second father and mother. According to the Vedic system of marriage, for producing children, every man and woman was enlightened in spiritual knowledge, and at the time of their combination to produce a child, everything was scrutinizingly and scientifically done. to the world, specifically to the Western English-speaking parts of the world, and not only in America, but those influenced by the British and the British colonies and the colonialization period, and thus English became a prominent, if not the primary language. So the English-speaking parts of the world, that's his audience. And what do such people value? So he unhesitatingly, confidently and boldly presented the Vedic paradigm. This is for public consumption. It's not a private discussion with disciples. It's published literature. Prabhupada made a distinction. Any sensible person will make a distinction between what you put in writing. He often said that, be very careful what you put in writing. You can say anything. I don't know if he actually said it, but sometimes people said he said, you can say any damn thing. But be careful what you put in writing. And he was careful. He knew what he was doing. And he's speaking the message of the Bhagavatam with specific reference to the 12th canto. And it's not only at the end of Kali Yuga, it's a principle of Kali Yuga. Now, it's not always like what's being described here in the purport, but it's a trend going in that direction. And I've learned this from interacting with Indian families. There's this expression that sometimes is used, a love marriage. And that's in contrast to the other kind. You could say the arranged marriage or the sanctioned marriage. But he likes her, she likes him, that's it. And as generations pass, the intergenerational issue of the younger generation, sons and daughters, being influenced by the modern generation's ideas of, without going into it too much, independence, drifting from the Vedic principle, the Vedic culture. So, the closer, a simple statement, the closer we stay to Vedic culture, the safer. And the rigidity, the not acknowledging the world around us and just being rigid, that's very possibly going to create rebellion. But there's an interesting, Devamrita Swami has shared some statistics on the Amish people. And the Amish people, the attrition of their next generation, the children, generally, very high percentage, don't want to leave their tradition. The world is around them. They see people living according to a different principle. And therefore, as young adulthood comes, they can easily leave their tradition and do like the people that are around them. But the attrition rate is very small. and they have some principles that, in my mind, they resemble Vedic principles, where there are elders, and the elders rule. They don't have an iron hand. But one example that I read, it was an article Devamrita Maharaj referred me to. One person became involved in Amish furniture. So, and without machines, making furniture. And he became ambitious to a degree that his safety was at risk. So the elders met and instructed him after their meeting, stop, here's the line, don't cross the line. Now he could have chosen to, I'm going to do it, I'm making nice living, I don't want to listen to you. But like the vast percentage of those that don't go away from the Amish tradition, he followed what the elders said. And he just, you know, he just cut. I can't recall the details of what was being told or the concern or whatever. But the respect of the elders. And of course, I could imagine amongst the elders there's not just age, but maturity and knowing where is reasonable, because the article is describing there are things that are sanctioned, and then they draw lines. There's things that are, you cross the line, that's cross the line. So that's an important function. In the Vedic model, it's an acharya function to adjust details without compromising principles. It's described in Nectar Devotion. In Nectar Devotion, at the beginning of one of the chapters, it says, this text is going to describe principles, and details can be adjusted and principles can't be adjusted. And making adjustments, Prabhupada made adjustments in details. That weren't part of the, you could say, hardcore or strong tradition. And he did so on the basis of a principle, the principle that anyone, living entity, can become qualified by Bhagavad Dharma, by hearing and chanting. And such a person, by hearing and chanting, it's very relevant to Kali Yuga. By hearing and chanting, one can become qualified. Like, what are you going to do with the population of Kali Yuga? Big problem. Because, as the beginning of the Bhagavatam describes, the sages are saying, the population in Kali Yuga is very unfortunate. What to do? And this is just at the beginning, what to speak of as Kali Yuga progresses. So unqualified persons that have bad sangskaras and bad karma and lower modes of nature, what are you going to do? The Bhagavad Dharma solution is engage them in hearing and chanting. And by engagement in hearing and chanting, that the karma can be eliminated, the influence of the darker modes of nature can be reduced, and one can become qualified. Using the simple metaphor of taking wet wood and making it dry. You bring the wet wood near a fire and it becomes dry, and then it can ignite. Bring persons to the mode of goodness from the darker modes, and then engage them in devotional service of the highest standard. Without detailing those details of adjustments that Prabhupada made, resting upon principle, that's an acharya function. And parenting requires a degree of that. in order to fulfill the function of parenting, that is, delivering dependents from the cycle of birth and death, that's pretty major. Parents have to be pretty qualified. And then how to deal with dependents who are involved in a culture that's off the rails and without all the detailing of modern technology and the distraction of modern technology and the brain-numbing influence and what's available through that modern technology that's degrading of character and eroding of values, and then children are exposed to all that and they're making choices. Going back to this model of the Amish, it's extreme in one sense, but there's a reason why they do that. It's not the same principle that we apply. The principle that we apply is Yukta Vairagya. But if we're going to do the Yukta Vairagya principle, it has to be anasaktasya vishayam, or at least training in the without attachment to sense gratification, Yukta Vairagya. That is, yatarham upayunjitaha nirbandha krishna sambandhe yuktam vairagya uchate. It has to be with Krishna is to be pleased. That's the Vairagya principle and the utility principle for the service of Krishna. So if something is suited for the service of Krishna, that's our family value. And then why? That's a big part of parenting. And then how to apply that principle with your dependents. Again, taking this language here, according to taste and character. Different members of a family may have a different disposition. It's only natural. Some similar, some quite dissimilar, and it's nature's arrangement. So, the point I'm making here is, aside from this topic of marriage and wanting to have successful marriages rather than unsuccessful marriages, this is an important principle. Parenting is another, just raising and imparting whatever parents are able and supposed to impart to their dependents, and the dependents understanding what the program is. Either it's the becoming connected to Krishna program, according to my nature, but the purpose is connecting to Krishna. And then families mixing with families, or communities. And it's natural, using one of Prabhupada's expressions, birds of a feather flock together. So persons of this nature, persons that like deity worship, they associate with the persons that like book distribution, persons that like kirtan, persons that like study of scriptures. Then there's different likings, and naturally there's combination of likings, and then there needs to be the respect of the core principle the unity principle that holds us all together as a community. That's Krishna is to be pleased. And you combine this and that and the other thing and the other thing, and you have Krishna is very pleased. More so than just we have our group and we do the things that we like to do, and Krishna is pleased. That this mood of respect, it's culture, is part of the unit. That's where it starts, is the family, and then families and families, and then groups of families, and groups of families with other groups of families, and culture. It starts in the home, and it starts with the parents in the home. Big responsibility. So this is just touching on one of the responsibilities of parents. Then going to now it's the Kali Yuga scene, where who really understands Vedic culture? It's a challenge. It's a challenge reaching out to people that don't know anything about Vedic culture. Then it's a challenge reaching out to people that think they know something about Vedic culture. And, you know, looking around the room and looking at the population that comes to the Potomac Temple, lots of people that are from Indian families that already have an idea of what Vedic culture is. Monday evening, two things. One is Maha Mantra. I asked the devotee that arranged the program at MIT, how'd you get so many people? So I don't know if there's time to take advantage of this, but he said, I found out that Facebook has a new facility you can purchase for a small amount of money, $5, $10 or something, an ad. You can specify who it goes to. You know, students from this zip code area. And the ad just goes to those people that are on Facebook, to those people. And there was a lot of people that came. MIT, there were 35 students. Well, 35, because some of them were older people. And I guess, you know, not necessarily even students. But you can, Prakash, you can find out from him, how'd you do it? I wanted to send him a letter saying, please inform the people that are doing, the following people that are doing college outreach, how to take advantage of this, because I've never seen MIT as tough nut. And a lot of people came. And then the same evening, Parmarupa's wife, Tulia, has a part-time professor position at Northeastern, and she's now, whatever the term is, something-something with the university for Hindu population. I forget what it's called. There's a term. So, you know, there's a Christian one of those, and then there's a Muslim one of those, and now there's a Hindu one of those, and she's one of those. She has that post. And so she has access to that their directory. And in the room, there were, it's maybe 50-50. Usually it's like 80-20 Western Indian, but this was 50-50 because it went to that list, the Hindu student group or something. 85-90 people Monday night at Northeastern. And then after the talk, there was a lineup of people that wanted to say something about their perspective on, you know, the Vedic paradigm. And it was like watching fireworks in the 4th of July. All over the place. I won't repeat some of the interesting displays of what the Vedic paradigm has taught them, the way that they've learned. Of course, it depends on the teacher. And it's very interesting. Quite Hindu. A little bit of everything. And amongst them, some persons were, you know, in the disposition of wanting to know. But most of them were just in the disposition of wanting to say. So it's a challenge. It's called the yoga. According to this little principle that we learned, Prabhupada says like this, a music teacher, one of the first questions they ask is, do you already play piano? And if they play piano, then the fee to teach that student is more than the person that doesn't know how to play piano, because you don't have to untrain the person that doesn't know. It's more work to untrain somebody that thinks they know. So there's an advantage of piety to be connected to the Vedic paradigm. It's a disadvantage to have a misconception of the Vedic paradigm, particularly when it's, you know, there's a strong buy-in to that other paradigm. In one sense, it's an asset. In another sense, it's an impediment. But certainly, the fact that, mere fact that people from born in India or some training from that part of the world culture, there's some sense of Krishna. Now, there's all kinds of different ideas about Krishna. We don't need to go into that. But just even the sound of Krishna, that's beneficial. A little Prabhupada story, and I think I'll end. One time Prabhupada was visiting in Chennai, and one Mayavadi sannyasi came to visit him. And he, making a long story short, Mayavadi sannyasi wanted to complain about Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita. And he had apparently, a scholar, had carefully studied Prabhupada's. So he wasn't just a scholar, he was a Mayavadi sannyasi. He requested an appointment, he came to see Prabhupada. There were people in the room, devotees in the room. And the Mayavadi sannyasi was complaining about his translation of Bhagavad Gita. Without, you know, details, but the conversation went on for an hour, where he was complaining, doesn't say anything about Krishna, and your purport, you're saying, you know, about Krishna. And then you have the Maha Mantra, and doesn't say anything about mantra, and any other place, and for an hour. And at the end, time was up, and Prabhupada said, Sir Prashadam. And then so after the Mayavadi sannyasi left, the devotees were puzzled and said, Prabhupada, normally you meet a Mayavadi sannyasi and you let him have it. You're like fire and you're Krishna's a person. But you didn't do any of those things. He said, because the man was saying Krishna name so many times, I was considering that next time he comes, perhaps he'll then inquire and try to understand just by the auspiciousness of saying Krishna's name so many times. And there's other nice examples of that. Articles were shown to Prabhupada and he appreciated, but even when they were interesting, even when they were critical articles, Prabhupada said, just see how many times he said Krishna, this is very good. And he would even say it's an indication that we're being successful. That, you know, they're saying Krishnas are bad. Krishna, 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 Krishna. If we were doing nothing, they wouldn't say anything. We're doing something. Now, he would then, of course, admonish those that were doing something that would bring criticism. Don't act in such a way it brings criticism. Anyway. This is Satya Yuga, and the principles of conduct, and particularly how marriages are to be considered by parents, and making due consideration. It doesn't make zero, he likes her, she likes him, but naturally the indication is if character and taste match, there'll be some liking. It's important that she likes him and he likes her. It's not a zero. Those who are in the caregiving position need to give that consideration. And astrological assistance, how do you know what the future holds? And how to even find a good astrologer these days. But if there are such persons, then it's good to consult in a, you know, such a significant direction of life, marriage. Okay, so any comments or discussion? Yes. Yeah, parenting.
So, especially my son, he's so new to the iPad. I mean, it's very difficult to get him off, like, he's out there and watching games or something.
Yeah, yes.
So, once he's with the gadget, it's very difficult to transition and come to the real world. I have this sort of struggle and I don't know.
Well, there was somebody that was sharing with me, due to influence, their son, the family went to spend some time with their relatives in India, and while he was there with the relatives in India, they introduced their son to meat eating, and the son bought into the idea of meat eating, and now what do I do? He's back, and he's still thinking it's a good thing, and is, you know, the so when there's exposure to things that are degrading and not elevating, or karmic and whatever, things to be avoided, one of the principles of parenting, it's not the only one, but one of the principles of parenting is education. What is there about being a vegetarian or not being a vegetarian? You know, there's lots of information out there. And then similarly, you know, not just say no, but lots of information out there about what are the effects of those things. The effects on the brain. The effects on the... I learned this one about... it's part of a presentation that I do about dopamine. Dopamine is an addiction-creating neurotransmitter that creates alcohol addiction, drug addiction, and other addictions, dopamine. And dopamine is released into the system with these devices, and so it's addictive. And it's not just children. I mean, just on this, on the flight from Boston to here, the man right across the aisle from me, the whole time, this is a man in a suit, was, you know, playing a little video game. It couldn't stop. You know, anyway. And then it's all kinds of, you know, playing cards, and, you know, that one of those things where the guy goes up and up, and then you have to do so many times you have to go back again, and they just do it for hours and hours. So, education. Educate yourself, and in a way that's not just I'm big, you're small, so you can't do that. It's education. Where's this train going? What's important to you? Where would you like your life to go? The decisions you're making now is going to determine tomorrow, and tomorrow is going to determine the next tomorrow, and where your life is going. Where do you want your life to go? What's important to you?
It's
the times.
But he doesn't need to listen either. I mean, it's like, so, you
know, all okay, so all you as a parent, all you can do is create an atmosphere and set a good example and try to educate. If they say, I don't want to know, you can't give knowledge to somebody who doesn't want to know. You can't. You continue the other activities. And, you know, then it gets into details. There's perhaps, maybe even probably, there's something inside that there's a hole that needs to be filled, and that's filling a hole, because I just feel, I mean, why do people turn to addiction of any kind? There's something, there's a need inside that's not being met. And that need isn't going to be met by the addiction. But there's the hole inside, the deeper thing. So how do you with as a parent or as a, you know, as a citizen, a friend of somebody that has, they're heading for the ditch, what do you do? If they don't want to, how do you touch the heart of that person? You have to wish them well and be a good example and be a genuine friend and not judge them. So that, you know, when they crash, that you're there to help them out of the ditch. But try the education approach. If there's no guarantee. Knowledge alone is not enough, because you can know that something isn't wholesome and you do it anyway because there's a hole. What's that hole? There's a course that a devotee named Ikshvaku has been teaching. He touches on this. The course is on counseling. He's been a professional counselor in Australia. So, and he had academic training, and then he became a professional counselor in different fields. There's counseling principles to help somebody that's in a toxic situation, and they continue. You can help somebody that wants to be helped. You can't help somebody that doesn't want to be helped. You can't push. They'll push back. They'll go further away. So at some point there has to be an acknowledgement that, you know, I'm in this toxic space and it's painful. Parenting. Anything else? Yes.
So we have read that Krishna's first division is Balarama and so on and so forth. At the same time, we also read that the souls have been eternal, they have been there all the time.
Yes.
So how should we decide what sort of acknowledgement souls, meaning the souls were created?
At what point?
The individual souls were created.
There's no point. As eternal as Krishna is, living entities are co-eternal. They're not appointed, so say it negatively. There's not a point at which living entities are created. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. Correct? Never was there a point in time. Nor in the future will there be. More souls will come into being. They're eternal. Co-eternal with Krishna. So you could ask, when does Krishna come into being? Krishna doesn't come into being. And even this other reference that you made, your question was soft, but Krishna's first expansion is Balaram. It's not that once upon a time was Krishna only and no Balaram. And then Krishna thought, gee, I think I need an expansion. Boop, there's Balaram. There's no point in time. It's an ontological relationship, not an event in time. Okay? Something else? Oh. Hare Krishna.
Character and
taste. Okay. Did you hear the question? There's a Sanskrit term, swabhava, and there is reference here to character and taste. How do they correspond? Well, there's first we'll go to the swabhava of the pure living entity, which is not what's being referred to here. Each of us, as spirit soul, have a swabhava, and that's connected to our eternal relationship with Krishna, our rasa, etc. And like, say, amongst the cowherd boys, they have a relationship with Krishna of friendship, and amongst the friends of Krishna, there's different swabhavas, this one, that one, the other one, the other one, and they have collectively a fantastic bouquet of swabhavas. Prabhupada says a vase of flowers that's only one kind and one color is not as attractive as flowers of various colors and various kinds. So it's that the fulfillment of Krishna's desire, so on the spiritual, so on the material plane, swabhava, one of the places that it's used, that term, is in terms of varna. Brahma karma swabhavajam, vaishya karma swabhavajam, kshatriya karma swabhavajam, etc. Swabhava indicates the prompt or the impetus from Prakriti upon the living entity due to not karma specifically, but the modes of nature. Due to the influence, due to past association, now each of us has a particular swabhava. That's the influence that the modes of nature have upon us. And that influence then manifests in different qualities. So the quality of the mode of goodness that's identified, samak, damak, tapak, shocham, shantir, ajam. So those are characteristics or qualities that arise from swabhava. Swabhava, again, is the modes of nature impelling the living entity towards a particular display of character. Now, how they correspond, that swabhava corresponds with quality, or excuse me, character and taste, those are aspects of swabhava. It's a subset of swabhava. So someone's character, for example, may be they're gentle. Someone's character may be they're aggressive. Someone's character may be they're entrepreneurial. Someone's character may be they like to study and reflect and understand things. So different. It's a subset of swabhava. Swabhava is the bigger picture. These are two subsets of that bigger picture. Yes.
Mahārāj, I have a question from yesterday's class about mindfulness.
About?
Mindfulness,
okay.
I'm trying to understand, is mindfulness and doing things consciously are being the same?
Well, the terms, they're not identical, but they're very close. Mindfulness specifically is the mind, and consciousness is the soul, which moves the mind. And the intelligence and the activities and everything.
When people practice mindfulness, they are not actually touching the conscious.
Well, not necessarily. That statement isn't necessarily correct. They may be. They may not be. Supposing I'm a greedy businessman. I'm going to be mindful of something. Supposing I'm a drug addict. I'm going to be mindful of something. I'll have mindfulness about my addiction. Wherever I am, whatever's going on, my mind is on my addiction because I'm addicted. So there's mindfulness. It's not where the mind is going, and now consciousness can be very dull, depending. It can be very high, or it can be transcendental, beyond high. Consciousness is specific to the soul. Conscious and consciousness. So there's an overlap, but it's not one-to-one. The terms are specific. What the mind does and what the seat of consciousness, where the soul is directing consciousness. Okay? Yes?
Maharaj, we are talking about Vedic culture.
Vedic culture.
Yeah. There are two examples that come to mind which are like slightly not the norm, like the one that's being mentioned in this verse here, where Kardama Muni's brothers were asked to marry the daughters of Kardama Muni. So typically in the Indian culture, it's like the brothers of the father are considered like the fathers. And we see here in the specific example, Lord Brahma himself is saying that. How to understand that?
I've heard this question asked before, and I couldn't really understand the answer. I can't, you know, it wasn't that, you know, this is the beginning of creation, so these are exceptions to the rule, because what choices are there? There aren't choices. However, there's some other detail about when it's okay and when it's not okay. Someone was describing this to me, that according to culture, it's auspicious to marry da-da-da-da, but not da-da-da-da. In a cousin or family type of relation. So these are cousins. So how does it work? I couldn't understand it. That's it?
Are these qualified persons who are like an exception to that rule?
Yeah. You're asking the same question, and I can't remember clearly the answer that was provided. And there were two circumstances. One, when Prabhupada was addressing the question. I'll see if I can find some, you know, Prabhupada said about it. But someone else was invading. Prabhupada was describing something about his family, you know, day. And then there's this, and then there's that, and then there's auspicious. It's okay this way, but it's not okay that way for marriages. You know, in amongst family members or cousins and so forth. I can't recall. Yes?
A technical question,
okay.
So, forgive my ignorance here.
My question is appearance of the law, Supreme Lord here. Even Brahma is appreciating Kalima Muni that he's going to get Supreme Lord as his son, and he's praising him as equal to the Lord and all
yes.
stuff on his verse. And the same case like in Bhagavatam that like Hiranyakashipu also had got a Supreme Lord as Prahlad, where like why the Supreme Lord appears like, you know, I'm trying to understand like, okay, he's a demon and then he's Supreme Lord is so merciful that he's giving a position as father to a demon. And even like in the Vamana Avatara that like he's giving a birth to a demon. So what is this perspective like, you know, is there is only good piety gives that like eligibility to have a son of a Supreme Lord?
Obviously not.
Because Vyasadeva, Vasudeva, like, you know, Lord Krishna's appearance also that he said so much of millions of years they were like meditating to get the Supreme Lord as their son.
Well, you should understand, I think you know the answer already. Krishna can do whatever he likes. He doesn't have to follow rules. So there's trends or standards, and he can do something else. There was a pastime. Doesn't have to follow rules. It's an exception to the rule. Then there's the rule. The purpose was to give, you know, to give protection to Prahlad. Why put, you know, take it back? Why put a perfected soul in a position where he has Hiranyakashipu as a father? For pastime. Why would the Lord do that? He would give protection to his devotee. Why put him in that risky situation? And we're questioning, did he make a mistake? Was he unkind? Pastime. Last question.
What I am chanting and who am I, why am I chanting, is it part of the mindfulness?
Part of being mindful, yeah, sure. That's your question? Yes, it's part of. Okay, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.